So, hello, good evening. For the fourth Vienna Music Business Research Days, we have a tradition that we have an evening discussion, which is a kind of introduction to the conference topic, the future of music licensing. And yeah, maybe the topic today, the question we raised, is might be the future of the music industry. I think our discussants will highlight that or not. So we posed the question, how creative is Creative Commons licensing? I have the pleasure that Sonja Bettel from the Austrian Broadcasting Service Ö1 will moderate the panel. And I hand over now to Mrs. Bettel for further information.
Thank you very much. Good evening. Thank you all for coming. Before I introduce our guests here on the stage, I would like to emphasize that you are welcome to join the discussion very soon after the first introduction from our guests to tell us or ask questions, tell us about your experiences, give ideas about how you would like to have this situation in the future, or maybe you are already working in some business or have some, as I said, experiences with Creative Commons or alternative licensing models or with the classic licensing and so on. So I would like to introduce our guests. I hope you can hear me fine. Is it okay? Okay, fine. Because here I don't have a monitor, so I don't know how this comes to you. Mike Michalke studied psychology. He's an artist and he's an early adopter of free music licenses. And he's a strong supporter of everything free when it comes to computers, hacking, and so on, and of course of Creative Commons. He's chairman of the Open Music Contest, e.V., which is an association for the encouragement of free culture, art, and science. And the Open Music Contest organized the Open Music Contest until 2008, which was a contest for open music, of course. And for the last 3 years, I think, Mike Michalke has been working together with others on the formation of the Cultural Commons Collecting Society, short C3S, it's a bit difficult. And he will tell us then what this is all about. Till Evert studied law and has a very long time experience in the area of intellectual property rights and licensing in the media and music business. Since 2012, he is CEO of the newly created ARESA GmbH, which is the Anglo-American Rights European Service Agency. It's a subsidiary of the German music collecting society GEMA. And the purpose of ARESA is, as the name says, the Central European licensing of BMG rights management for online and mobile. This is the Bertelsmann Music Group. Mm-hmm. And the establishment of ARESA goes back to a suggestion of the European Commission from 2005, I read. Mr. Evert, what was the substance of this suggestion, and how is ARESA meeting this recommendation?
So the recommendation was basically the idea of the EU Commission to say the internet is international, and so maybe the licensing structures should also be international. And before the recommendation, it would have been possible to also have a pan-European licensing structure, but the recommendation from the EU Commission gave the political signal that this might be a good way forward in terms of licensing, publishing, and authors' rights. And so it basically led the floor on a political level to establish companies like ARESA. There are others in the world like Sellers and Paycol and deal, which represents other rights holders. And basically the idea is, again, to put everything on a pan-European or international basis, which means if there is a licensee who wants to have rights not only for a specific territory, that he can then obtain all the relevant rights for online and mobile use from one source for all territories which he would like to be licensed in. And so that was the basic idea of the recommendation. And there was, of course, additional layer, which I think is very, very, very important, and that was to say we want licensing of authors and publishers' rights in a very efficient manner, and we want it in a very transparent manner. And that was the second and third layer of this recommendation, which we try and hopefully meet in the founding of Ariza.
Can you explain a little bit how this works, and why is it only a BMG rights management? Why is it not everything, so to say?
Yeah, that's maybe already the first link to Creative Commons. I think most of the, I have to be very open, the publishers founded all these entities, or were partly, at least trying to establish these companies. So the idea or the situation we're in is that most of the rights holders want their individual solution for licensing rights. And that's the reason why the publishers chose to have their own vehicles and to license on an individual basis. So the idea really, or I think the core idea was to say we want our own licensing tool where we can somehow implement our own ideas and come to our own conclusions, which might not be the same as another rights holder might have. So that was basically the idea behind founding these entities.
I think we will talk about this more later. Mike Michalke, what was the idea behind the Cultural Commons Collecting Society, and how shall it work? Because it's now in establishment.
Information. Yeah, the C3S project, I'll go big back in time to explain what we are doing and why we're doing it. The project was officially started in 2010, but the problems we are trying to solve or address arose some years earlier, when in 2005 we were organizing the first open music contest to promote Creative Commons licenses on the one hand, but on the other hand, to globally inform musicians about copyright and how copyright could work in the digital age and so on. Because we felt that copyright is a very important tool and something that you must have at least some basic information about if you're publishing music, because there's rights you have, and if you don't know what rights you have and what rights maybe your fans have, then problems are programmed. So one of the biggest problems from our point of view was that releasing music under Creative Commons licenses and being member of a collecting society were not compatible. Because usually when you sign a contract with a collecting society, you grant them some exclusive rights, and then you cannot pick individual songs and release them under other license terms. So that was an issue, and from a first glance, this looked like, for us, okay, then don't be a member of a collecting society and the problem is not there anymore. But what it actually meant was that you are suddenly shut out of a lot of markets, like being paid for when your music is played on the radio, if it's played in a club, if it's played live, and so on, if it's pressed on a record, because usually you need a collecting society to get money for this, because a radio station won't make individual contracts with every piece of music with the artist that is played. So the problem was, how do we get Creative Commons licensing if an artist thinks that's an interesting tool, with being in a collecting society? So for the first years, we tried in talks with the GEMA to establish Creative Commons inside GEMA, but after some years, it was obvious that there were structural problems to make this happen, even though a lot of people we talked with inside GEMA themselves said, well, that's an interesting license concept and it may be worth giving it a try, but our members don't want it. And what are these members? Then we looked at the structure of the collecting society, and I think it's similar here in Austria, that you must make a certain amount of money over some years to become a member with full voting rights. In case of the GEMA, this is, please correct me if that's wrong, 30,000 euro over 5 years. Then you can have the right to fully make decisions with the other members in the General Assembly. And all other members, which is the majority, about 95%, are only represented by a few delegates. So if you look at this, then it's quite obvious that those who are making the most profit of the way that this collecting society is functioning right now are probably not so interested in changing things. So this gives stability, but from our point of view, maybe it a bit too much stability for this collecting society. So then it was obvious that the only way to really help this problem would be to found our own collecting society, which is for the most part very similar to that what the GEMA is already doing. But in certain aspects, like all members should have equal voting rights, and we want to support all Creative Commons licenses, not only a few of them, these things are the ones that we want to have in this collecting society, and that's what we're working for 3 years now.
At which point are you at the moment on your roadmap?
We have last night released an announcement that in mid-July we will start a crowdfunding campaign for the actual founding of the juristic corpus, so to say. We want this to be a European cooperative. So it's a cooperative design opposed to the structure that a lot of collecting societies usually have. They are societies or GmbHs, usually, for the most part. And that founding will take place in September. So, and then the next steps will be to really work on the infrastructure that you need as a collecting society. So we will not be a collecting society in September, but we will have the cooperative. And maybe in 2 or 3 years, we can try to get the license from the German Patent and Marketing Office in Munich.
My first question to you is, there has been a lot of critique versus the GEMA, I think it's mostly in Germany, of course, but there was critique on other collecting societies in Europe as well, of course. But we're now talking about GEMA versus C3S, so to say. Is the GEMA going to change, or is it possible that different sorts of licenses are possible in the future? Or is the situation that you say, or that GEMA says, we will stay in the way that we are? Of course, there are now these subsidiaries for online and so on. This is already a change, of course, but the general structure of the society.
I think, as you rightly mentioned, already the existence of RISA, for example, is a step from the old way of licensing. And it's basically a reflection of the pressure which is on all collecting societies to adapt to whatever the need in the market is. And so I think, again, these kind of societies like Arisa or Sellers are the first step. There will be others following, of course. But as Mike said, at least I can only speak for GEMA at the moment because I know the internal structure quite well. It's a very, you wouldn't maybe laugh, but it's a very democratic way because, of course, there are certain regulations which might have a higher weighting factor for members who have a higher turnover per year or per 5 years. But nevertheless, the I would call it the working level of GEMA is bound by whatever the assembly decides. So, of course, if there is a certain movement which then leads to a situation where the assembly decides we want this or this or this structure, then of course GEMA has to abide by this and would have to follow this. So that's point number one. But on the other hand, it's difficult that the working level itself decides to follow a different road. So I think nobody should underestimate how sensitive the collecting societies are, in the sense that they now realize that there are different interests in the market and that they have to somehow accommodate these interests, because otherwise, as in this concrete example, it will get difficult to convince authors and composers or publishers to join the respective collecting societies. So I think the old thinking that collecting societies are monopolists is maybe de facto still true, but at least speaking for GEMA, the mindset is now very clear due to these option three entities, which clearly showed that you are no longer a monopolist because publishers could withdraw their rights and establish something new. So I think it's a real mind change going on, and collecting societies realize that they have to somehow fulfill the needs of their members. But again, if the members decide we want it this way, no collecting society could go in the other direction. So that's, I think that's maybe a very formal answer, but that's definitely true. We can't do something which is not somehow supported by the membership, or at least the majority of the members. Yeah.
I think the critique on the collecting societies was one thing is that people are missing transparency. It's the same in other collecting societies, not about music. And then the other is that's why it's called the name of the new collecting society looks, or the logo looks, and the name sounds a little bit like Creative Commons, because people are have different needs nowadays, that they don't want to have all rights reserved, but some rights reserved. That's why Creative Commons was developed. But how big is this need? What kind of artists or creators are these that have these needs, and why are they not found in GEMA, obviously, or is it a group who decides that is maybe too old or too established to think about these kind of licenses, maybe?
I think it's difficult to talk numbers in this particular
it's
problem.
More
because
who are, what kind
because,
of... Yeah.
Because if there is obviously no possibility to have a market with Creative Commons licensing, you cannot know how many artists would actually be interested in doing it if they knew they could nonetheless make a living out of it.
Hmm.
So this is a rather new licensing concept. The first licenses were released, I think, in 2001 or 2002. They borrowed a lot from things that worked very well for 20 years in the free software movement. And the attempt was to make licenses not for software, but for anything else, which is a cultural product, but trying to have the same freedoms that free software developers grant to their users. So, but in the software world, you don't have this problem, because collecting societies are not available for software programmers.
Mm.
Usually. So as a free software programmer, you can very easily make a company and sell services around your software, like a lot of companies do, and they have a lot of stock exchange now and are quite big companies. And there's a lot of funding going into free software development, so there's millions that are spent every year on free software and on free software development. So if there is a market, it's not a question of how restricted the license is for a certain piece of work, cultural work, So we are very convinced that once you open the gate and make a market possible, that a lot of musicians will say, yes, we think this is a way that licensing in the modern digital age can work, and we want to give these freedoms to at least, say, non-commercial use, so that it's easy for our fans to promote us by using our music in video clips and so on.
There is this statement of GEMA from January 2012 that GEMA is really not interested or doesn't fit in the structure allowing Creative Commons licenses for the members of GEMA. Why is this, and is it really so that most of the members of GEMA are not interested in Creative Commons licensing?
We have the General Assembly next week, and I'm there every year, and so I of course speak to the authors and composers, and of course this is not an answer which reflects the actual situation and the way how the authors and composers think, but my feedback is basically that for them, GEMA is not 100% perfect in all things they do, but they are more or less happy with it. I'm sure, as Mike said, if the new society is established, that some authors and composers might think maybe it's good to join the new approach. I don't know, but that's something which we have to see. What is important for me, I always fail to understand Creative Commons license for me means at least primarily to say I'm able to open my work and my creative output to the public and to make it possible to everybody to listen to my music make everything transparent in a certain way. And we have to somehow differentiate. I think the approach of GEMA is to say we want authors and composers to get a remuneration for what they're doing. So our focus is more to say we want that the licensing structure leads to a situation where all authors and composers get revenue and can somehow make a living from it, which for a lot of authors, to be frank, is not possible, because they don't earn a lot of money. But the focus of GEMA is more to make this possible, to get revenue, which then is allocated to the authors and composers, apart from other things, of course, doing political lobbying for them, also cultural aspects, which are very important. But I think that's maybe a focus which is important to differentiate. The focus of GEMA is more to make money for the authors and composers, whereas my feeling is that the initial concept of Creative Commons was more to make music available. So it was basically the first step of, I think, two steps. The first step is to say I can make music available and public, but then my personal feeling is if I have to live for my music, then I need to have some revenue. And my feeling is that the Creative Commons license is only the first step. You then need a second step to actually make money. And I think that's really the core difference between the, I would call it, GEMA approach and the initial Creative Commons license. Now I realize that you are also founding a collecting society, which obviously is the second step I just mentioned, that you also want to make money with your creative work. And that's why I think in the second or on the second level there won't be too many differences. I agree that if you want to have a structure where everybody has the same voting right, that's definitely a difference between GEMA and the new society. But as far as transparency is concerned, I think I'm not sure. If it depends on how many members you have. If you're talking about GEMA has 60,000 members, represents 2 million authors and composers worldwide. So it's quite a lot of people you have to somehow make happy. So it's not really easy. I don't know whether you heard that GEMA, together with PRS, which is the British Collecting Society, and STIM, the Swedish Society, now really want to make the project happen, which basically ensures that the money is transferred to the authors and composers very quickly and very precise in the details as far where is the money from, which is the revenue source, which for me as an awesome composer might be the most important one, so that everybody really then understands where the remuneration is coming from. So I think that's an important point, and I'm maybe I'm too optimistic, but I'm really looking forward to what your plans in this respect might be, because this I think is the core function of a collecting society, to make visible what is done with my creative works, how am I remunerated for my works, and also to give the authors and composers a cultural, a creative, and a commercial feedback how music is consumed, I would call it, in the market. And this is something which is, I can tell you, these three societies invest a lot of money to really make this project working in the sense that every author and composer understands what happens with his creative works. And maybe the question to you, Mike, because I think that's a fundamental thing, how the new collection society which you are envisaging would like to solve that. Because again, I think this is the benchmark for an author or composer being happy with the structure he's in or whether he's unhappy.
Yeah, may I answer to that?
Yeah,
for the most part, almost everything, I totally agree with what you said. To begin with, I wouldn't compare Creative Commons, neither the licenses nor the non-profit organization, with a collecting society, which would be a bit like comparing a collecting society with the copyright law, because this is just a licensing term,
yeah,
and not the collecting society itself.
Yeah.
That's why we are now trying to found a new collecting society. And to maybe clarify this, our goal is not to force anyone into using Creative Commons licenses. So we will also accept musicians who think Creative Commons is a stupid idea and just want maybe a more democratic collecting society or whatever.
Mm.
There are certain differences between our concepts. But we want to enable them to choose for themselves if they want to use Creative Commons licenses. If you think you want to do that, you don't have to decide this for all of your repertoire.
Mm.
You can just take one song and use it for a PR campaign to make you more visible in the market or whatever. So of course, philosophically, we think that the Creative Commons approach is a very important one and something that we want to strengthen.
Mm-hmm.
But we would take away another freedom if we said everyone must use Creative Commons licenses.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the idea behind
mm-hmm.
this. We simply want to enable this, to have this option as an author to say, okay, let's try with this release how the Creative Commons thing works.
Mm-hmm.
How much money do I get out of
mm-hmm.
this? So, but this is, as of now, it's not possible. And for the philosophical thing, the licenses are called Creative Commons. So, of course, there's the idea behind that, or the mindset behind is, if you want to have a vivid market, you must first have creativity and interesting works, something that people like and that they want to that they want to work with, that they want to have. And on top of that, you can build a sustainable market. That is the idea behind this.
Mm. So maybe two answers. So maybe I'm more publisher driven, but my feeling is that the publisher doesn't really like a scenario where an author and composer is has already separate licenses, so they to a certain extent have an exclusive approach on everything, which again nobody needs to like. So again, the focus is if you are a musician and you want to make your living with music, then and you want to be published by a publisher, I would call it the traditional publishers. Again, there are a lot of other publishers who might have a different approach, but if you want to be published by a traditional publisher, it's for them at least very important to have the exclusive rights of everything, which to a certain extent doesn't really fit into the Creative Commons model. Again, if somebody says, I'm more interested that everybody can listen to my music and I find a different approach to make money, be it on the basis of concerts, be it on a distribution deal with somebody else, then that's fair enough. But so maybe put simply, it's more the decision of following a more traditional way of things or following a more, I would call it a more...
Adventurous.
Adventurous. Adventurous, maybe that's a good word, yeah. So that's, I think, and as you say, I think everybody has to choose what the best option is, because for somebody it might be the perfect option to say, I want to have my own creative environment, I want to have my own way of exploiting my own repertoire, and others say, I feel more comfortable if I have an expert who does licensing as a publisher for 100 years. So that really depends on who you are. I'm really honestly saying both ways could be possible for everybody. What my only question back to you is, because you mentioned that GEMA to a certain extent was not able to implement a Creative Commons license in their membership agreement. One aspect, by the way, is because GEMA and I think all collecting societies or nearly all require exclusive rights, which again doesn't really fit into the concept of Creative Commons.
Yeah, it's impossible.
Yeah. There are other aspects which also play a not unimportant role. My question, or I think one commercial aspect was to say it's difficult for a collecting society who represents, again, GEMA represents 60,000 composers, to differentiate on a case-by-case basis. Is it now a Creative Commons license? Is it a GEMA license? Is it a non-commercial license? Is it a commercial license? You would have to, if you want to license a licensee, you would have to decide per author and per work whether it's in or out, whether it's commercial, whether it's non-commercial. And that's something which has a really heavy knock-on effect on your costs as a collecting society, which then again negatively affects the distribution to the authors and composers, because if you have to invest a lot of money to decide is it in or out, is it commercially exploited or non-commercially exploited, that money then is somehow lost from distribution to the authors and composers. So that's an aspect why, apart from the legal aspects, which I think are, to be frank, the killer argument, which are also a philosophical question, whether you want to save money by doing it maybe in a very conceptual, abstract way, or whether you want it to do it on a case-by-case basis.
I don't think that is so much of a problem. I mean, technically, this is a question of asking your database. I mean, for each production that is done today, say, producing a CD, each title has to be checked by GEMA whether this title belongs to their repertoire or not. So there's already, for every production and for everything that is played, if a radio station needs to list it, there is already this housekeeping. It's not that on a track-by-track basis you decide whether this or that case fits, but you already do this kind of looking up, okay, this is a song that we get money for. I agree that our approach is maybe a bit more complex for the more freedom you get as the author to decide this track goes this way and this track is classic copyright and I make my deal with the classic publisher who wants all rights reserved, so you can still do that, but you don't have to. And I mean, looking at another thing, when you say we have so many million authors that we represent, I don't know how many million users Facebook has right now, but it seems to be very good at still deciding to know who has which friend and who shall see this message. So this is basically a technical question. And of course, we need to find a way to make this not so costly that no author gets anything. But I wouldn't say that it must be really much more expensive than what the GEMA structure already is.
Is it a direct answer? Because then I would like to ask the audience something important.
It's a direct answer because I think we somehow neglect the perspective of the DSPs, so the licensees. If I negotiate a license with Apple, Google, Amazon, whatever, they want to know what they get, but they want to get it in one sentence. They want to get it on the phone. They want to know, what do I get from you? And my feeling is that if Creative Commons says, one time I'm in, one time I'm out, maybe it's commercial, maybe it's non-commercial, it gets, at least from a licensee's perspective, very difficult to know what repertoire have I licensed right now. I appreciate, again, that if you look at a database, then you can always compare and say it's in or out, and so on and so on. But a clear message to Apple or to Google or to Amazon or whomever to say, this is my repertoire, is very difficult to somehow accommodate. And this is something which shouldn't be underestimated, because if such a big DSP or whoever doesn't know what they get licensed, it's really problematic. I can really say this is something which can hold up negotiations for months. It's a really complex point.
I think that's a very interesting topic. Before I go to you, I just wanted to make sure that, because first you said some time ago that people want to earn money with their music, because it's important to say that Creative Commons licenses are not about giving away everything for free, because there are different licenses. And I think that's very important as well for this question, how do we find out which kind of license is on this certain piece of music. And so I wanted to ask if knows Creative Commons well enough to understand this. Okay, people are saying yes. Okay, and then there is a question, please.